afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop from Washington. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress. I am here every Wednesday giving you the Inside Scoop from the nation's capital. And then I'm joined with Leslie Marshall in the second hour at 4 o'clock p.m. In that hour, we're going to talk about the Republican threats to do something about President Obama's executive order on immigration. The dirty little secret is there's nothing they can do. And that's a good thing. We'll talk about that in the second hour. Then you've got Leslie by herself in the third hour talking about whatever she wants to talk about. Glad to be with you today. Got a bunch of things I want to discuss. In the first hour, I want to go over the allegations against Bill Cosby. It's troubling, and it should be troubling to all of us. Obviously, I, like most Americans, I dare say, am a fan of Bill Cosby. I like his work. I like his comedy. And I was very, very saddened to hear of these allegations. And the question arises, well, why is it that the women who make these allegations, some of them are just coming out with that story now? Well, I've got a great guest, best-selling author, Sergeant Stephanie J. Shannon, to give us an idea of why victims of sexual abuse often wait so long to speak out. So that's coming up after the break. Before the break, I want to talk a little bit about Ferguson. I'm going to be on television. If you live in the local Washington, D.C., Baltimore area, you can tune in to the local Channel 5, Fox News, at 5:30 p.m. By the way, if you don't live locally, go to my website, marklevinetalk.com. I'll have a link there if you want to watch. I'm going to be talking about body cameras because I think they are the secret to resolving this knotty question of not only what happened with Darren Wilson and Michael Brown, but to try to prevent these kinds of police shootings nationwide, at least the unlawful ones, and to really to help rebuild, or maybe in some cases just build, a kind of good feeling between community and the police that simply does not exist right now. When you look at the marchers in Ferguson, I found dramatically different points of view. Now, you know, I think that obviously virtually everyone agrees there should be no violence, and the vast majority of marchers, it is, we need to point out, have not been violent. In fact, most of them haven't even committed civil disobedience. They have legally and peacefully marched. But I've seen this really dramatic difference of opinion based on people, black and white, liberal and conservative, who, let's face it, have no idea what really happened that fateful day between Officer Wilson and Michael Brown. I've heard people talk about the majority of witnesses, and we should point out that 16 witnesses say that he turned around and had his hands up. That's substantially greater than the three or four witnesses that says he charged Wilson. But that was Wilson's story, and he's sticking to it, and we're in not a he said situation, but a he said, he did situation, where Wilson could tell his side of the story, and Michael Brown can never speak up for himself. This was part of the problem with George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. By the way, I do think there was sufficient evidence in the Trayvon Martin case, based on the 911 tapes, based on Zimmerman's own incriminating statements, to convict him of voluntary manslaughter. And I said that on the air. I don't think there's enough evidence in this case one way or the other. And in fact, I think it's actually fair that Darren Wilson was not charged, because I think it's fair for the prosecutor to come to a conclusion that the evidence was so double-sided, as it were, so contradictory, that we could not prove Wilson guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, which, of course, is the criminal standard. Now, that doesn't mean I think the prosecutor did the right thing. I'm quite convinced, in fact, he did the wrong thing. A prosecutor has discretion. We're going to talk about that with regards to President Obama, who's the ultimate prosecutor when it comes to immigration law. A prosecutor has discretion to take a good case, to not take a good case. In President Obama's case, he's decided to focus on the criminals that break the nation's laws, that are violent, and those immigrants, rather than the undocumented immigrants that have been living here for decades peacefully. And prosecutors, police officers, show discretion all the time. You're at a cop, let you out of a speeding ticket, and if you've ever done is, as I concede, I there's only laws that I regularly break. I go faster than the speed limit, knowingly. I admit it. But I don't get caught most of the time because there's not a police officer every single time around when I'm speeding. Because, and I think this is a good thing, they're focused more on murders, rapes, sexual assaults, financial crimes, and even drug crimes, which I don't think is great, but to a much greater extent than they are my speeding. So prosecutors, police officers use discretion all the time. And if the case against Darren Wilson could not be made strongly enough, it's perfectly fine for the prosecutor to say, you know what, there's not enough evidence here. I cannot get a jury to convict beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm dismissing the case. That's not what the prosecutor in St. Louis County, Bob McCullough, did. Instead, he went through a farce. He convened a grand jury and then handled that grand jury in a way that virtually no prosecutor in the nation ever, ever would do. Instead of making the case against the criminal defendant, the putative criminal defendant, Officer Darren Wilson, the prosecutor basically tried and convicted Michael Brown. He acted instead like the officer's defense attorney. He allowed him to speak before a grand jury. Ask your neighborhood prosecutor if they've ever allowed the criminal defendant to speak before a grand jury. They allowed Officer Wilson to tamper with the evidence. They basically actually did more than even a defense attorney could legally do, because a defense attorney is not allowed to ask leading questions. The prosecutor is supposed to prosecute criminals. He's supposed to take the adversarial stand against the criminal defendant, and we rely on the criminal defendant's defense attorney to defend him. Instead, Bob McCullough acted as the officer's criminal defense attorney, which I could believe is entirely improper. Now, all that being said, that doesn't mean I know what happened that night. I'm sorry. All those people that say, well, you know, Michael Brown charged him, you don't know that. And all those people that say, you know, Michael Brown did nothing wrong, you don't know that either. We don't know what the witnesses saw. The testimony is contradictory. By the way, the best chart I've seen of all the witnesses and what they said or didn't say, you can find at the PBS NewsHour. They've got a list, a great list of all the different witnesses and all the contradictions. You'd be surprised to find all the places they agree, by the way. They agree that Michael Brown turned around. The vast majority say he did have his hands up. So don't mock the St. Louis Rams for that protest with their hands up. Michael Brown, according to the majority of witnesses, had his hands up. But at the end of the day, the only way we can know the truth in these difficult situations is with body cameras or dashboard cameras. And I'm going to go on local news at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can check it out to talk about the why I support body cameras. So the website's marklevinetalk.com. Check that out. In the meantime, coming up next, I've got Sergeant Shannon, and she's going to talk about why victims of sexual assault often take so long to speak up. It's Cosby, innocent or guilty? How can we know? We're going to discuss that when we come back. If you want to call in, 888-653-7543. This is Mark Levine, Sergeant Stephanie Shannon, back after the break. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Bill Cosby is a beloved American, including by most of us who've never met the man. We like his comedy. We liked him on The Cosby Show. He was an early African-American appearing in a white culture, and he's funny. But is it possible, or even probable, that he committed sexual assault on what's now, I think, 20 women? They've accused him of that. But most of the accusations have come about just recently. So who are we to believe? And why would a victim of sexual assault take so long to speak out? The toll-free number is 888-653-7543. To help answer these questions, I've invited Sergeant Stephanie Shannon to come. She's a best-selling author of a book entitled Battling the Storm Within. She's an honorably discharged, disabled U.S. Army veteran who served her country for 8 years, including in the Desert Storm War. And she has her own story to tell on this very subject. Sergeant Shannon, thank you for coming here on the show.
I appreciate the opportunity.
So let's start it. And again, I wouldn't ask such a personal question, but you've laid it out in your book, and you're on my radio show, so clearly you're able and willing to talk about it. Why don't you start with what happened to you, and then we'll move on after the break and talk about Bill Cosby.
Okay. Well, what I experienced was during the Desert Storm War was military sexual trauma. Military sexual trauma is just recently coming out since 2012 publicly about all the different sexual allegations, sexual harassment, things that happened in the military that occurred. And most of the victims, like I was, did not tell. I held my secret in for so many years because I was afraid to report it. There was no safe system of reporting.
Let me go back a bit, Sergeant Shannon. When were you sexually assaulted?
I was sexually assaulted in the 1990-1991 war.
While you were serving your country, while you were in, I guess, Kuwait, a member of the military assaulted you?
That's correct. And I also had two other friends that were raped during that time.
Now, is this a commanding officer or is this someone of your same rank?
Not the same rank. At that time, I was a private first class.
The person who assaulted you, is this someone whom in the regular military context you'd have to follow his orders?
Correct. He's one of my leader superiors.
Okay. Yeah. So that's obviously a very difficult situation. You're not in the United States, you're in Kuwait, you're thousands of miles away from home, and the person who you would complain to is the person who raped you. Now, was there a way in 1990, and I don't know if it exists today, we can talk about that too, but let's just go back to 1990. Was there a way for you to complain to perhaps his superior officer? Was there a way to do it that you didn't use or didn't feel you could use?
No, not at all. There was no quote-unquote safe system of reporting. What happens is you have the chain of command, and you have to go up the chain of command. So any issue you have, you have to first tell your direct supervisor. And those were the people that were sexually harassing me, causing a sexual assault. They were the problem. So actually, I couldn't go any farther than them.
And this man assaulted you and two other women?
Well, yeah, it was different accounts. The other women were sexually assaulted by another leader. Another woman was sexually assaulted by a peer comrade. It was going on.
I see.
On a regular basis.
And you really didn't feel that you could go to this was a sergeant who assaulted you?
Yes.
You couldn't go to a lieutenant or a captain or someone he reports to and say, look, I need you to know that this sergeant assaulted me.
No. For one, you don't jump the chain of command. That's out of order. I was threatened. When I started complaining about what was happening, I was put on harder detail. I was ostracized. I was put on watch guard and duty by myself for 12 to 14 hours.
So you did complain about it?
I complained about it to them, but that's about how far it went.
To them, meaning you're the man who raped you? You complained to him?
Yeah, my leaders, yes. Yeah, because I had squad leaders. Yeah, I told them about their behavior and how they was conducting themselves. And I was threatened with Article 15 and disobeying lawful orders. So I was intimidated and bullied.
So Article 15 is how you punish someone who disobeys an order in the military.
That's correct.
And what is that punishment?
Well, that's based on your commander and the offender. I was just threatened with it, so it didn't actually happen. I believe it was just a tactic, a bullying tactic.
So when did you first talk about, outside the military, what happened to you in 1990?
I didn't talk about it anymore until about 20 years later. And it came out of my book. That's basically the book came out of journaling. When I decided to get therapy, I finally felt safe and felt like I could disclose it. So I carried it for 20 years.
For 20 years, you carried this secret until you got therapy. What's it like to do that, to live with a secret like that, that you don't feel comfortable telling anybody?
I call it an invisible wound, and it caused a psychological disorder for me. What it did, it affects my interpersonal relationships, the way I saw life. I just didn't tell anyone because I didn't feel safe. You know, I would say a few things here and there, and people would minimize it or, you know, put it on me and ask me, what did you do? You know, and I would question them nothing. You know,
when did you get out of the military?
1998.
Okay, so even after you're out of the military, 12 years went by before you felt safe. What were you worried about after you're out of the military? I understand you can be punished in the military, but 1999, 2000, 2001, what were you concerned about in those years?
I wanted it to be over with. I didn't really realize how much it, damage it caused me until I burned myself out. I ended up becoming a disabled veteran, taking up my job as a social worker, couldn't function anymore, and I ended up becoming a homeless veteran. And that's when I started to look at the issue and wonder where this all stemmed from.
Now, you have reported it now, presumably, but I guess it's too late. 20 years have passed.
Well, I really, you know, after that much time, I just wanted to forget it. I acted as if it didn't happen. And I think that was most, you know, most veterans, veterans that experienced that. They just wanted to kind of stay under the radar. But I more or less was reported it for the fact to get help. So the VA really has stepped up their game to provide mental health and psychological services for veterans that experience military sexual trauma.
And what, if anything, ever happened to the perpetrator?
Nothing at all that I'm aware of. I more or less took the tactic or strategy of forgiving them. I really didn't want to go through the legal aspect. I didn't want to fight my leader. I just wanted them to stop.
And I don't mean to be too graphic, but you were actually raped.
I was sexually assaulted.
Sexually
harassed. I had one friend that was physically fully raped, but I was sexually assaulted. So it's a broad category there of what's considered military sexual trauma.
Okay. After the break, I want to move on and talk about Bill Cosby and specifically about the power dynamic. You were in a different power dynamic. You're in the military, suffering from your commanding officers, but these women were in a social power dynamic. Some of them were aspiring actresses. Bill Cosby was certainly a very famous person 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and he had the power to make or break careers. It's a different power dynamic, but it still is one. I want to talk about why these women might have waited so long to speak out and whether you believe them. I also want to know, folks, if you believe them. 888-653-7543. What are your thoughts on these allegations and the fact that they're just coming out right now? This is Mark Levine, right back after this. Welcome back to the show. Bill Cosby, whatever acts he did, most of them seem to have happened long ago, prior to the statute of limitations running out. So the question is, why would all these people, these women, accuse him of these crimes now? As his spokesperson said, and this is a direct quote from them, this is Cosby's attorney, quote, "These brand new claims about alleged decades-old events are becoming increasingly ridiculous, and it's completely illogical that so many people would have said nothing, done nothing, and made no reports to law enforcement or asserted civil claims if they thought they'd been assaulted over a span of so many years." Okay, that's Cosby's attorney. Now, what about the alleged victims? There are 20 of them now. They come out more and more each day, including a man by the name of Frank Scotty, who's a 90-year-old man who said that he sent payments to women totaling some $2,000 per month, was asked to do that for Bill Cosby, in addition to some 20 women, all of whom have a relatively similar story in the sense that they say that Bill Cosby gave them basically a date rape drug, a pill that he slipped in their glass that made them pass out and then allow them to be raped. My guest is Sergeant Shannon. She herself was sexually assaulted, took 20 years to report her story. She's the author of a best-selling book that you can get on Amazon. The book is entitled, let me get the title right, Battling the Storm Within. Sergeant Shannon, before I get back to you, I want to get a caller on the line who, frankly, doesn't feel the Cosby allegations are statistically possible. So let me let him give his view, and then I'd like you to comment on that. William from Cleveland, thank you for calling in.
Thanks, Mike. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. So you don't believe the allegations?
Honestly, no. It just is so weird to me that after 20 years, nobody would come forward before that. Up to 20 victims, and nobody would speak out. I mean, statistically, that just seems very, very, very unlikely to me.
I believe there was at least one woman who did speak out years ago, and I want to get these facts right. I don't have her name in front of me, but it was just one. And most, there's no question, the vast majority of these women are just speaking out now. When they hear that other women are speaking out, they speak out as well. That's true. But let me, Sergeant Shannon, why would at least the vast majority of these women wait 20, sometimes 30, sometimes 40 years to tell their stories?
The same reason I did, and several other female and male veterans say the same thing, is that the fear of retaliation.
Now, what are they afraid of? Now, you at least could be afraid of a superior officer, you know, putting you on Article 15. That made sense to me. But you've got some 16-year-old wannabe actress or some 23-year-old woman. Sure, Bill Cosby is a very famous person, but he's not their commanding officer. What would they be afraid of?
I would be afraid of a negative reputation. No one likes a rat. For one reason, when you come up and you're public like this, you're going to get scrutinized, you know, just like what he's stating. For one, none of us know Bill Cosby personally. You know, I'm not saying he did it at all. I'm stating from a victim's point of view why it may take so long. You got the shame. You know, you have your name out there, and then you actually may have to go through a court proceeding. And whatever the decision may be, you're going to have to bite that. So a lot of it is unknown variables there. If I tell what will happen, what is my name going to be like? What is going to happen to me? So I think it's more of those issues. And a lot of times it's best to try to tuck it away, act like it never happened. But what happens is when you don't deal with any type of violation, a rape or sexual nature like that, it eventually deals with you.
Now, do you think, Sergeant Shannon, that the fact that there's some 20 women and some men who at least say they paid some money to these women, is that enough for you to believe the allegations? I mean, how do we know, particularly 20, 30, 40 years later, how do we know who's telling the truth?
Well, like I said, none of us were there. You know,
right?
But it's a possibility. It's a possibility that there's a factor there. For one, Bill Cosby is not even speaking out.
Right.
He's more
that's
or less
true.
Discounting these issues. He's not saying yay or nay. So that's a questionable action there. And then, who make these 20 women that came out, it would definitely be for one, I would say, what per person account. We would have to hear each story and hear exactly what they have to say in order to make any judgment call like that.
Let me go back to my caller. William, do you think that all 20 women are being basically opportunist? And I don't know, what's their motive? Is it getting money? Why would they say this if it weren't true?
Yes, you hit the nail right on the head. I'm thinking it's more of an issue of I'm looking for a payday more than I'm looking for justice, to be honest. And in the civil court, say if it were to go to civil court, well, that's an issue where it's not going to have to be reasonable or without a shadow of a doubt or
right.
Whatever.
It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a preponderance of the evidence is the civil court standard. Basically, a court decides who is more likely to be telling the truth, but you don't have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Exactly.
And I should tell you that the lawsuit that's just filed recently, I think it was this week, against Bill Cosby, that woman's going to have a hard time, not based on the facts of her case, but because she alleges, I believe, that he molested her back in 1974, and the statute of limitations has clearly run. I suspect she'll lose, but that doesn't mean that Cosby didn't do it. It means that she'll lose because we have statutes of limitations that basically say if you're not accused of a crime in a certain number of years, you get a free pass. But let me ask you, William, the fact that there's 20, that there's so many, and there's even some men who clearly aren't trying to cash in. I mean, this guy, Scotty, I believe is his last name, or Cioti, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. This 90-year-old man who used to work for Bill Cosby and apparently paid some $2,000 a day to various women, I can't imagine his motivation. Why would a 90-year-old man who wasn't raped, this fixer, so to speak, why would he make this stuff up?
Well, that's a good point. And all right, we weren't there, so we don't know
right.
what happened. But I'm saying more than likely, again, this is just people being opportunistic. As far as the 90-year-old man, I don't know. Maybe he had a falling out with Cosby at some point. I mean, we just don't know. People have all kind of motivations for the things that they do. I'm just thinking.
That's true. But let me ask you this. I mean, is part of the reason why you're defending Bill Cosby so much because you like his art, you like his comedy. I mean, I like his comedy. I admit it. I used to listen to his record albums 30 years ago. I mean, I've been following him for a long time. But just because I like an artist's work, that shouldn't matter one way or the other into whether or not I believe the guy, right?
I mean, yeah, of course. I grew up watching Bill Cosby. I'm not saying he's innocent of all charges just because I grew up watching him on The Cosby Show. I'm just saying it just seems so weird to me that only one out of 20 people would come forward if this was really going on.
Okay, let me go back to Sergeant Shannon, because this kind of thing happened to her. And so Sergeant, you hear the kind of skepticism, you know? All these women waited 20, 30, 40 years. It's really unlikely to be true. And people think that. This caller, reasonable. So why is it, in your case, in other cases, why are these women waiting so long? I mean, it's not 1 year, it's not 2 years, it's 20, 30, 40 years. They just want to forget it happened? Is that it?
Yeah. Well, yeah, in my case, no one believed me anyway when I told them. They did just exactly what he's doing. He discredited. I was not credible. No one even supported me. So I suffered by myself. And then sometimes what happens when one come out, another one's going, oh, my God, maybe I should. Maybe it's safe now. And I think that's what kind of happens. That's what's happening now in the military sexual trauma arena. People are starting to disclose all this stuff, and they're like, oh, my God. Like, one of the statistic to share this with you, 1 in 3 women in the military are raped, and 38 men are sexually assaulted every day. That came from the Pentagon.
In 3? You're saying that one-third of every woman serving in the military has been sexually assaulted?
Correct.
And not just sexually harassed. I mean, sexually harassed could be calling a name. You mean physically touched in a way she didn't want to be touched.
Correct. That's, and 38 men.
And you say that statistics from the Pentagon?
Yes, correct.
That's extremely severe. I mean, that's
yes, it is.
That's huge.
And it just came out in 2013. So look at all these years. So can we say that the victims are not legitimate and their issues are not? That's what most of us don't tell, because no one believes us.
What about Williams' arguments that because Bill Cosby is certainly famous and certainly rich, that some woman who met him 30 years ago can simply claim that he raped her and maybe cash in? Either from some tabloid or from a lawsuit. I mean, is that possible?
Yes, it's very possible. Even in the military, I saw some of the women throwing themselves at the men, and they put themselves in a position to be sexually assaulted, fondled, or whatnot, in which I saw, I was like, well, you kind of asked for it. Myself, you know, I've seen it. So, yes, it's a strong possibility.
How do we know who to believe?
I think it's going to have to come out. I think it's going to have to be some level of investigation, some pressure put on Bill to speak up and be held accountable. I think that's the only person that really knows that's going to admit this, but he's not talking.
William, what do you think about the fact that he's not talking, that Bill Cosby literally is maintaining his silence? I mean, he won't even say I didn't do it. He just simply will not address it at all. Does that in your mind suggest that maybe he's not innocent?
No, to me it's him not wanting to give credibility to accusations that he views as utterly ridiculous. So I don't blame him for not wanting to speak or say anything. I mean, to him it's probably just out of left field and ridiculous.
Well, to say it's out of left field and ridiculous, again, I don't know whether he committed sexual assault or not, but let me read to you from a Washington Post article that came out. This is November 24th, so it's about a week or two old. And again, I don't mean to suggest that the women aren't to be believed, but the reason I'm mentioning this man is because he can't sue and get damages, right? So the title of the article, and you can look it up on the internet, everyone can, it's called "An Alleged Cosby Fixer, Quote Unquote, Comes Out of the Shadows." And it talks about Frank Scotti, who was a facilities manager at NBC, charged with standing watch outside Cosby's Brooklyn dressing room. And he said that he would send payments to women, including actress Angela Leslie, one of the ones who's claimed that Bill Cosby sexually assaulted her, and that he had bags of $100 bills, and the payments totaled $2,000 a month. And he said, quote, "I did a lot of crazy things for him. He was covering himself by having my name on it. It was a cover-up. I realized it later. The man is 90 years old." I mean, how does that allegation strike you?
Again, it's at this point, it's hearsay.
Well, let me give you another one. Sure. A woman by the name of Teresa, I'm probably masquering her last name, but Serenyes, it looks like to me, Teresa Serenyes, said she received a wire transfer from Cosby via his agent at William Morris. Now, wire transfer, there's a record of. She said, so we can prove that. He said Cosby sent more than $100,000 to Sean Thompson. Thompson's daughter, Autumn Jackson, claims Cosby is her father. Now, it seems to me, if I were Bill Cosby, and I did not have sex with Autumn Jackson's mother, Sean Thompson, I would say, you know what? I'm going to put all these allegations to rest. Let's do a paternity test. Those things are, you know, 99.999% accurate. And if she's not my daughter, I'm off the hook. Now, there may be a different story. He may have had sex with her and not, it was not sexual assault. But if he never met this woman that he sent $100,000 to, you know, he has a way out of that one, right?
Yeah, I would agree to that, sure. Right.
I mean, again, it's possible that Autumn Jackson is his daughter, and it wasn't sexual assault. It's just possible they had sex. And let me go back to Sergeant Shannon, because Sergeant, you know, two people have sex, nothing wrong with that. You know, afterwards, it becomes a he said she said kind of story, and it's, I mean, immediately after sexual assault, there are rape kits, there are ways to show, you know, force was used and so forth. But 20, 30, 40 years later, it's practically impossible to prove sexual assault.
Correct. I think a lot of times, you know, it depends on how far these women want to push it. Are they trying to get money, or they just want it to be out to free themselves, hold Bill Cosby accountable? I don't know the extent of that. I know for myself, I wanted to heal myself. I wanted to be free from all the shame and guilt I had and from the invisible wound they inflicted on me. So that's what my perspective was. So, yes, it's a strong possibility.
Go ahead. Finish your thought.
I'm fine. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say this. It should be noted that the majority of these women – and there's some 20 women in each case is individual, but the majority are not seeking money. They're not suing Cosby. Mm-hmm. They're simply speaking out. And when you think about it, most rape victims don't want to say they're a rape victim. There's a stigma, and I think it's wrong, because if you're a victim, it's not your fault at all. It's no more fault to be a victim of rape than it is to be a victim of anything. I mean, you know, in any crime where it's, you know, it's not your fault. There's a stigma attached, and so I would have to ask why all these women who are not seeking money are coming out and saying what they're saying 20, 30, 40 years later, when they're all leading, you know, probably decent lives and haven't seen Cosby in decades. Why would they all speak out? The other thing I should note is that Clarence Thomas had a similar record of women coming again and again and again, charging him with sexual harassment. People didn't want to believe that either. And sometimes I wonder if we don't want to believe because, hey, we like Bill Cosby's work, or we like Clarence Thomas's views. So we have to be careful about that. Folks, if you want to call in, it's 888-653-7543. Thank you, Sergeant Shannon, for sharing your story. And again, her book is you can get it on Amazon. It's a bestseller. It's called Battling the Storm Within. I really appreciate that. I appreciate your call as well, William from Cleveland. When we come back, we've got the Talk Radio News Service, and then Leslie will be on with me in the next hour talking about President Obama's immigration policy. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. I got Luke Vargas from the Talk Radio News Service on line one talking about, it's a serious, such an ugly, terrible thing going on. What's the latest, Luke?
Well, not too much changing on the ground in Syria, but here at the United Nations headquarters, there has been what really appears to be a big step back for the humanitarian response to the Syrian crisis, which is that the World Food Program, which is in charge of feeding the 1.7 million Syrians that have had to flee from the country, has basically, not gotten any money for December for any of its programs.
Any money from the UN or from donors? How do they get their money?
Yeah, from member states as well as from individuals can contribute also. So they're $64 million short for December. So for the first time in the nearly 4 years of this civil war, they're basically ending their food assistance for these refugees.
They're going to let the refugees starve?
For many of them, there are some secondary options, and it looks like they will probably be successful in whipping up sort of the guilt factor and getting these donations in.
Why can't they use other stuff in the budget, you know, the stuff that goes to the expense accounts of a lot of those UN diplomats? I can think there's some fat in that budget.
You'd think so also. I talked to the head of their program in Jordan today, and they said, look, we were forced to do that back in September and August when we were also complaining about this. They took out a huge amount of internal loans, so they've just basically stretched it too far. They're now reaching out to the public using social media, but this is really not how it's supposed to work. They were supposed to get these contributions, and they said they weren't naming countries, but they said a number of countries that had gone public saying they were going to contribute a certain amount just didn't follow up. So
did they not name the countries?
They did not.
They should. Is the United States one of them?
No, we have done a pretty good job. We're paying for basically half of this program to begin with, and USAID has been releasing statements over the past few days saying, look, other people really have to step up and sort of shielding themselves from the criticisms that they should be doing more. I think 50%, maybe we could always do more, but 50% seems like more than our fair share.
I'd like to see Saudi Arabia step up. You know, these are Sunni Muslims. Saudi Arabia claims to be the leader of them. They certainly have the money. We're not asking a poor country to step up. And this is a country that's got more money than they know what they can do with and should be making sure that these refugees get fed. Otherwise, they're going to die. I'd like to see them and other rich Arab Gulf nations step up. Is there any indication that they're the ones that aren't paying?
Again, I wasn't able to twist their arms enough, and I haven't seen – there are a lot of other good outlets working on this. They haven't even been able to leak anything from a pretty easily leakable United Nations, so I'm not really sure where to point the blame at this point.
Okay, real quick, there's also danger to the refugees in Kobani on the border with Turkey. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, 2,000 of them have fled to this sort of temporary border corridor, and unfortunately, Turkey did not clear out hundreds of landmines that are still there, left over from the 1950s through the 1990s. And so far, three people have been killed, nine injured. Human Rights Watch is demanding that Turkey expedite and basically go there right away and start removing these mines. But it's really, you know, just insult to injury for so many of these really vulnerable people.
Well, Luke, thank you for your report. I got to tell you, I've been concerned about the Syrian refugees really ever since this crisis began back 3 years ago when the government of Syria just started massacring its own citizens. And I have long said that the reason why ISIS exists is not because ISIS is evil, but because basically Assad is killing his own people and people turn to ISIS in desperation. The way to stop terrorism is to stop Assad. Thank you, Luke. We'll be back at the top of the hour with our discussion of President Obama's immigration policy.
Welcome to Hour 2 of the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine reporting live from Washington, D.C. Leslie Marshall will be on with me in just a minute. We're going to talk, well, maybe a half hour or so, but we're going to talk about the President Obama's executive order on immigration. Now, if you've been reading a lot of the right-wing blog posts or watching Fox News, or maybe just like I've been getting a lot of harsh talk on Facebook, a lot of people have been complaining about it. They call it the executive order on amnesty. They call it unconstitutional. What is it that President Obama actually did? Well, the short story is it's heavily constitutional and has nothing to do with amnesty. Let's start with the amnesty question, because there's this idea that President Obama is legalizing millions of undocumented immigrants. All he's doing is saying he won't deport them. There's no citizenship given. There's not even a green card given to these people. Many of them have been here for decades. None of them have committed any crimes other than being here in the first place. So it's not amnesty. And then comes the question of constitutionality. What power does the president have to do something like this? Well, would it surprise you to know that every president in the last 50 years, dating back to President Eisenhower, has issued an executive order on immigration?
There are 39 executive orders issued over the last 50 years, just about one a year. Every president's done it, including Ronald Reagan, both Bushes. In fact, George Bush Sr. actually issued an order that caused some 40% of undocumented immigrants at that time not to be deported. Guess what? In this case, President Obama, there's 40% that won't be deported. Basically, this is a question of prosecutorial discretion. The president is the leading law enforcement officer on immigration, and he has the right to decide who's going to go first. And I think we can all agree that the violent criminals and all should be deported much before these families that have been here for 20, 30 years and are working hard and trying to live the American dream. So the president decided to go after the criminals first. After all, he doesn't have enough money approved by the Republican Congress in order to deport 11 million undocumented immigrants. So what is the problem with the president's executive order? Let me know. Just call in 888-653-7543, agree or disagree. This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back right after this.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. I'll be joined with Leslie Marshall in probably around the half-hour point. She's delayed a bit in traffic. But we're talking about President Obama's immigration executive order. And also, I do want to and open up for discussion. If you haven't heard, it's just been reported that in the Eric Garner case, you may know the case, another unarmed black man, killed by police, this time in New York City. He is someone, it's interesting, that the police were arresting for selling cigarettes without paying the cigarette tax. So I have no problem with the police enforcing the law. I support cigarette taxes, but it's hardly a violent offense, right? It's hardly a guy that's just robbed a bank or committed sexual assault or is a drug dealer or anything like that. The allegation is that he resisted arrest. There is a video, which is interesting because, I support body cameras. And in the video, he shouts, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe." They put him in a chokehold. Those chokeholds are against the policy of the New York City Police Department. Now, Mr. Garner was a big man. He was 6'3", 350 pounds. He was a large person, to be sure. But that, to me, would suggest even stronger reason not to use a chokehold. You know, I don't really like tasers, but tasers are better than chokeholds or shooting somebody. And it seems to me that that may have been, if he was resisting arrest, and the video should show that, that would be something that you could use a taser for. Again, I don't know the circumstances. I wasn't there. I have not seen the video. I do know that the grand jury chose not to convict. But I also know that grand juries do what the prosecutor wants them to do in 99% of cases. So my real question is, what did the prosecutor tell the grand jury? I don't know about these prosecutors that go on, like the one in Ferguson, and present a case to the grand jury without a recommendation. Prosecutors should be out to get criminal defendants. That's their job. Now, if you say that's unfair, well, criminal defendants have defense counsel. And that's our adversarial system. That's how it works. I'm a lawyer. That's how it works. You defend your side to the hilt, and the other guy has his side defended to the hilt. And at the end of the day, a jury and a judge decides, and there's appeals, and it's all done by law. That's our system. It's called due process. It's guaranteed in the Constitution. Well, when a prosecutor acts as defense attorney, the whole system gets messed up. No one is representing the victim. And the victim already has got some real difficulties. He's dead. So it's very hard to tell your side of the story when you're dead. And so the perpetrator often gets away with telling his side. At the very least, you'd want the state on your side. Now, again, I fully admit I have not studied the Eric Garner case to the extent that I have the Ferguson case. And if I've got some facts wrong, I encourage you to call in and correct me, 888-653-7543. But it seems to me that prosecutors should make the case against these possible criminals and then let a jury decide. Now, again, there's a video. Maybe the video completely exonerates the cop, but what I don't understand is chokeholds are against NYPD policy. So if they're against NYPD policy, why would they put in the guy in a chokehold to begin with? It's a real question for me. Anyway, I'm going to study this case more and more, but don't be surprised if you see protests about Eric Garner now in addition to Michael Brown. Coming back to immigration, and again, I encourage you to call in and give me your 2 cents on it, 888-653-7543. If you don't like President Obama's policy, then, and you're a Republican, then there's a clear, easy answer. What's your alternative? Make an alternative. It's not like President Obama came in his first day in office and said, I'm laying down the law, I'm going to do this executive order on immigration. No, he waited 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. And only in the end of the sixth year of his presidency did he finally say, you know what, the Republicans aren't going to do a thing. And to be fair, the Senate Republicans did act. A bill passed the Senate by a 68 votes, more than two-thirds of the Senate. That's enough to pass a constitutional amendment, by the way. That's enough to overturn a veto. More than two-thirds of the Senate voted for a bipartisan bill that was pretty tough on undocumented immigrants. It required them to wait, I think, 13 or 14 years or so before they could get a green card. I mean, that's a long time to wait for people that have already been here 10, 20, 30 years. But it gave them a path to citizenship. It allowed them to come out of the shadows. It made sure that they weren't being discriminated against by their employers. Because let's face it, if an employer can pay an undocumented immigrant, I don't know, a dollar an hour for a job, that's not only unfair to the hard worker, and let me tell you, these people work very hard. I don't know anyone who argues that the Mexican-Americans that have come to this country aren't working extremely hard. But it also undercuts the American citizen. The American citizen who's worried about his or her job being lost to an undocumented immigrant. Well, your job's going to be lost if they have to pay you minimum wage, and they have to follow safety regulations with you, and they've got to pay you overtime and so forth. And they don't have to do any of that. They don't have to follow any labor laws with regard to the illegal, the undocumented immigrant that's there. It seems to me that if we go after employers and say, you know what, you got to pay the minimum wage, you got to pay overtime, you got to treat them safely. You can't put people up in trees without a harness so that if they fall, they break their neck. It's cheaper for employers to mistreat employees. It has always been so. That's why 120, 30 years ago in the factories throughout the United States, you know, you're in the food factory, they're cutting up meat for slaughter, and your arm gets caught in the machinery, gets chopped off, it falls in the meat, and you lose your job. Read all about it in Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. That's the way business was, and that's why we have these labor laws. But it's important to understand that the labor laws are not just because I have compassion for undocumented immigrants who are coming to live the American dream, who are trying to do, frankly, what virtually all of our ancestors in America did, come here with nothing and live the American dream. It's not just that. It's about American citizens, too. You cannot compete as a worker with someone who's willing to work for much, much less. That's why we have minimum wage laws, right? That's why we don't pay people a dollar a day in America. So by policing the employer and making sure that employers follow the labor laws, it doesn't just protect the undocumented immigrant. It protects the American citizen worker as well, who can compete on equal terms with the undocumented immigrant. It's a win-win. And yet, you go to my Facebook page, go to Mark Levine Talk, and you can see people who are angry. Get them out of here. They broke the law. They have no right to be here. Get them out. To which I say, unless you are a descendant of Native Americans, unless your family is Cherokee or Choctaw or Sioux or any of the hundreds of Native American tribes that inhabited North America prior to the arrival of the white man and the black man, unless you are – now, if you're a Native American, if you're Choctaw and you don't want anyone here, you know what? You've got at least an argument. But if your ancestors, like 90% of our ancestors, came as immigrants, or the 12% of us, they came on slave ships. If your immigrants' ancestors came from outside of North America, I'm not sure what right you have to complain. My great-grandparents came here with nothing. They came. They lived the American dream. They worked very hard, and they did quite well for the generations that followed. And I got to tell you, I think these new immigrants, They worked just as hard as our ancestors before us. 888-653-7543. Charles in Santa Fe, New Mexico. What are your thoughts on immigration? Hi, Charles. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? I was listening to you. I'm from Santa Fe, New Mexico. We have a lot of illegal immigrants here, and I've worked with them. And, you know, I've seen how they work. They work hard.
I'm sure they do.
Hard.
In the sun, I assume they work very hard with, long, long hours at probably very low wages and just to try to survive.
Yeah, they're worried about their kids especially, you know, because the kids don't get deported, you know, unless they want to take them with them. And by this time, they were born here. They don't speak Spanish.
That's right.
So you're taking them to a country they can't really get along in school or whatever. And I thought it was about time to stop all this deportation thing of parents. That's breaking up families. I know these people. Yeah, I've worked with them. I've had to. I worked at a mental clinic. And something, and I'm wondering what the hell is going on in this country.
So you firmly support President Obama's executive?
Absolutely.
What do you think of all the animosity against it? It's probably not occurring so much in New Mexico. But next door in Arizona, you see a lot of it. What do you think? Where does this animosity come from? Is it pure racism, or what's going on?
I think it's a psychological mind control thing by the Republicans. They've been doing it for years. They do not like minorities. I'm a minority. I'm Spanish. But my family came here from Spain 400 years ago. If I'm not I was born here. So, but
I don't even know why we call you a minority. I mean, your family came 400 years ago. The people on the Mayflower came here 400 years ago. My family, I'm a newcomer. My family only came here 120 years ago. So I realize I'm new here. But I'm not sure what the difference is between people whose ancestors came here 400 years ago, 100 years ago, or 10 years ago. They're all just trying to live the American dream, and I don't really see the difference between any of them.
Well, some of them are already here. So this was part of Mexico at one time.
Well, that's true.
It was part of Mexico. They were here already.
You know, the irony is, that's a really good point. Many of the Mexicans that are crossing the border are of mestizo heritage, which means a mixture of the Spanish and the Native American heritage, which means they are more native to the Americas than the descendants of the English or the Germans or the French or whomever of the Africans that are complaining about them. they're more native to this land.
I don't know why. I wish I could understand the Republican Party. Why are they down on everything? Well, it's intimidating. It keeps people underneath the bed or whatever, worried about going out and being found out and being, put in jail. There's thousands of kids in the detention homes right now. They're only little kids.
Yeah, I've often wondered if New Mexico, and I don't know, maybe because of its name, New Mexico, or its culture, an old Spanish culture in New Mexico that, as you say, long predates the U.S.-Mexican War in the 1840s. Whether New Mexico has more sympathy than, say, Texas or Arizona, states around you that seem to have no sympathy for these people.
Yes, we do. New Mexico has always been on the side of minorities who come here. Arizona, no, not so much. California, yeah, not too bad.
So what's the difference? Why are people in Arizona and Texas less sympathetic than in New Mexico and California? Is it just that they're more white? I mean, let's be blunt about it. Is that the difference?
I think that's part of the thought process. They're not us. And whites too, they come here and from all over the world.
Sure.
And they cause problems. And it's not only Mexicans. Our border was very porous at one time. Oh, we got a lot of them, but they came here to work.
The other thing people should realize is that some 40% of the undocumented immigrants in this America did not cross the southern border or the northern border. They came by plane. They overstayed their student visa. They're from all over the world. They're from Europe, Asia, Africa. It is about 60% from the south. Not all Mexico, by the way. El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and so forth. It's funny when people talk about the undocumented, they almost always think of Mexicans when almost half are people from all over the world. They're not.
Yeah. Well, their way of life is terrifying. Just to walk out and try to have a good time. You know, they have their own restaurants, they have the wonderful Mexican restaurants in Santa Fe.
I'm sure there are. Charles, thank you for calling in and giving your perspective. I really do appreciate it. When we come back, hopefully we'll have Leslie Marshall join us as we continue this discussion. This is Mark Levine. You can follow me on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk or on Facebook as well. Just go to Facebook.com/Mark Levine Talk. We'll be right back right after this. What have we
done with innocence? Hey there, I'm Leslie Marshall. Remember me? getting back from the Fox News television studios, normally a breeze and get here on time, but in Southern California, when it rains, it's sort of like a blizzard in the Northeast. People just stop. Also, because it hardly rains and we've had a 3-year drought, the oil builds up on the freeway, and then when you have nobody to wash it down, it becomes just so slick out there. There are numerous accidents. And of course, with so many mountains and hills, a lot of mudslides. But I'm here, and I'm glad that my buddy, my co-host, was able to go it alone. He always sits in the first hour here on the Leslie Marshall Show every hump day in hour one, and glad that he could stick around without me for the past half hour. But now we are back together, Mark Levine.
We are together again,
Mark Levine and I. Mark, I know that you touched upon the media circus around Ferguson. But I think you touched upon the bipartisan or maybe not tax plan, and the long-term tax break plan has fizzled. But now let's talk about something else that really Republicans are hoping they can fizzle out, and it's not health care, but obviously any option at all, even though it only seems they have a few for Republicans to block the president's immigration plan. And before we do that, Marky Mark Grimaldi, our executive producer, was nice enough to pull some stuff I had asked him to pull earlier today. And let's play that first up. Does that work with you, Mark?
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
Let's do this. This was a 2-hour and 23-minute immigration executive order hearing on Capitol Hill. It was a very long hearing. It got kind of heated. And you're going to hear an exchange between Congressman Mike McCaul, a Republican from Texas and chair of the Homeland Security Committee, Congressman Benny Thompson, a Democrat from Mississippi and a ranking member on the Homeland Security Committee, and Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson. Listen up to some of this.
There's a right way to do this, and there's a wrong way. And unfortunately, the president has taken the wrong way. History has proven that amnesty perpetuates a cycle of illegal entry into this country. This is true in the 1980s, and it has proven true under this administration's abuse of prosecutorial discretion.
Time and again, the House Republican leadership has been unwilling to act to fix our broken immigration system. In the face of this crisis and the absence of congressional action, the president acted in a measured way that is likely to improve both our nation's security and economy.
The reality is that, given our limited resources, these people are not and have not been for years priorities for removal. It's time we acknowledge that and encourage them to be held accountable. This is simple common sense. For decades, presidents have used executive authority to enhance immigration policy. President Obama views these actions as a first step toward the reform of the system and continues to count on Congress for the more comprehensive reform that only changes in law can provide.
The lax interior enforcement policies adopted by this administration, coupled with even the perception of amnesty, become a powerful magnet that encourages more illegal immigration. We essentially tell citizens of other countries, if you come here, you can stay. Don't worry, we won't deport you. The reality on the ground is that unless you commit multiple crimes, the chances of your being removed from this country are close to zero.
A fair criticism may be that vulnerable people in violence-ridden communities in Central America will be misled by enterprising coyotes and smugglers about the scope of individuals covered by the president's action. Even if there's an upsurge based on misinformation, Congress has made significant investment in personnel and equipment at the southern border that should ensure that DHS is able to effectively respond to any increases in attempted border crossings.
If we don't think that message is making its way back to Mexico and Central America, we are simply fooling ourselves. We will see a wave of illegal immigration because of the president's actions. At its core, the president's unilateral amnesty plan is deeply unfair to the millions who are waiting in line to become a part of our great nation.
I know that there are some contemplating some form of short-term CR for the Department of Homeland Security to get us to March. That is, in my judgment, a very bad idea for Homeland Security, because during that period of a CR, we cannot engage in new starts. We've got some Homeland Security priorities that need to be funded now. For example, we're back in a presidential election cycle. I cannot hire new Secret Service agents until I get an appropriations bill passed by this Congress, not another CR for a couple of months. I cannot continue to fund our enhanced detention capability in Texas with another CR that gets me to March. I need the help of Congress to support and build upon border security, which I believe all of you support. So I'm urging that we act on our current appropriations request now for the purpose and for the sake of border security and homeland security.
Mark, echoing the sentiments of the president, and of course there are a lot of people that have questioned the timing of the executive order. But speaking of timing, Congress has had more than enough time in the House to draft their own legislation, which they have not. And they wouldn't even put to a vote the legislation that was passed on a bipartisan level, and that pretty much ticked all the boxes for both Democrats and Republicans, to seal the border, and Democrats to provide a pathway for citizenship. Another thing I want you to touch upon with me is, for decades, nobody seemed to care, left or right, and especially Republicans have seemed to really care now, about these undocumented workers. They didn't have a problem with them paying taxes, approximately $100 billion into our Social Security and Medicare systems. They didn't have a problem with corporations hiring these illegals, and they turned the other way. So why now? Why is it because of the growing demographic? When you talk about timing, let's turn the tables and ask about timing with regard to Republicans and their accusations.
Well, first of all, I think if there's a question as to why now, the real question is why not before? Not why now. I mean, we're in the last 2 years of President Obama's presidency. There's a real question as to why he didn't do it sooner. I think that's a fair question. But I think President Obama was giving Republicans a chance to come up with ideas of their own. As you point out, Leslie, they refused to do that. And they largely refused to do that because they know that the Senate bill that you referenced would pass by a large majority of the House, probably two-thirds of the House. I suspect virtually every Democrat would vote for it, and probably 30% of the Republicans as well. But you got to remember that the vast majority of Republicans are in gerrymandered districts. They come from districts that are almost entirely white. They're not Latino. They're not black. They make it very careful that their districts do not include Latinos, blacks, or other minorities, because they know that they can count more on the white vote. So these are representatives that don't represent America. They represent some very, very racially homogeneous areas of America. And I'm sad to say that there are some conservatives, mostly white people, who have forgotten that their ancestors came to Ellis Island, that their ancestors came on the Mayflower. However their ancestors came, they came just like these people to try to live the American dream. And I think they just want to close down the Statue of Liberty and pack her up and pull up the gang ladder behind them. I don't understand it. To me, this is what America's all about. We are a nation of immigrants.
Yeah, no question about that. I had heard another audio piece, and I forgot to tell Mark which piece I wanted. But Jay Johnson, and I don't remember who he was talking to be honest, because I've been listening yesterday on and off to this hearing that was very lengthy and trying to have my life work, take care of my kids in between. But Jay Johnson was an attorney, and he got very angry when, oh, thank you, Mark. Can we play that exchange if we have that? I would appreciate it. Listen to this. Okay, that sounds good. What we're going to hear is an exchange about the legality, which I wanted to talk to Mark about because he's an attorney. He works inside the Beltway, and he knows that Constitution left, right, up, down, inside and out, backward and forward. Jay Johnson, I thought, made some very good points. And I like when people sitting before congressional members, whether the Democrats or Republicans posing the question, when they call them out on their caca, on their doo-doo. Here it is.
The president said over 20 times that he did not have the legal authority to do this, to take this executive action, and that this is not how democracy works. Do you agree with that prior statement?
Chairman, I know from 30 years as a lawyer that when someone paraphrases remarks from somebody, I want to see the full Q&A. I want to see the full context to know exactly what the person said. I've looked at various excerpts of remarks by the president concerning his legal authority to act. I do not believe that what we have done is inconsistent with that. In fact, we spent a lot of time with lawyers, and we spent a lot of time with DOJ's Office of Legal Counsel. They wrote what is, in my judgment, a very thoughtful 30-page public opinion on the available legal authority to act to fix
the situation. And I have no doubt about your actions after the election on this issue. But I will say I will be happy to provide you with the written statements that I have personally read to your office. It is confusing, and it poses a bit of a hypocrisy, I think, to the American people, because then after the election, he reversed his course. After the election, he says that now he does have the legal authority to move forward. And so we don't know – who should we believe, the president before the election who said he didn't have legal authority to take this action? Or the president after the election who says that he does have the authority to take this executive action?
Congressman, what I know is we spent months developing these reforms, and we spent a lot of time with lawyers, very close consultation with lawyers. There were some things that they told us they thought we did not have the legal authority to do, which is reflected in the OLC opinion. And there are things they told us very clearly that we did have the legal authority to do. The analysis was very thoughtful, very time-consuming, and very extensive. And I'm satisfied as a lawyer myself and the person who has to come here and defend these actions that what we have done is well within our existing legal authority.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, Mark, let's talk about this. Let's talk about if the president even, you know, alluded to, and if they're definitely twisting words here of what the president said, the president meant, and also the legal authority that the president is commander-in-chief and the executive branch of our government has the right and the power to do, and what past presidents have done as well. We'll be back with my co-host and partner in crime here on the only true democracy in talk radio, 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. So never forget the phone and join us. Mark Levine and I will take your calls. Follow him at Mark Levine Talk. Follow me at Leslie Marshall. That's following us on Twitter. Tweet us there. We'll share your tweets throughout the remaining one segment in this hour when we return. Former legislative counsel to Democratic Congressman Barney Frank in the House Judiciary, Homeland Security, and Financial Services Committees, Mark Levine's my co-host today and every Wednesday, hour two, on the only true democracy in talk radio. Check out his website during the break, marklevinetalk.com. Don't go away. We are back on Leslie Marshall. He's Mark Levine. I'm in L.A. He is in D.C. And he's a former legislative counsel to Democratic Congressman Barney Frank and the House Judiciary, Homeland Security, and Financial Services Committees. Well, Mark, you and I both had a lovely little audio fest there, which happened yesterday in Capitol Hill, not far from where you are. And first of all, did the president, in fact, state prior on numerous occasions that he did not have the legal authority to do what he just did via executive order?
No, he said he did not have legal authority to give legal status to the undocumented immigrants. He'd been asked several times by people like me, like you, who want to allow the 11 million immigrants to have a green card, to have the right to stay in the United States, to have a path to citizenship, if he could do that. And he said no, he couldn't do that without congressional authority. His executive order does not give these people a path to citizenship. It doesn't even give them a green card. It doesn't give them a work permit. All it does is it says that in deciding who to deport. And Congress didn't provide him enough money to deport all 11 million undocumented immigrants. In deciding to deport, we're going to go after the criminals first. We're not going to deport these people who've been here for more than 5 years and have family here and haven't committed any crimes. All it was him using his prosecutorial discretion to say, I'm going to deport the bad guys first. I'm not going to go after these people who really are just trying to live the American dream. If he had given them legal status, if he'd given them a path to citizenship, if he'd given them amnesty or a green card, then they'd have an argument. But he didn't give them amnesty. There's no legal status here. There's no path to citizenship for these people. I think there should be, but the president doesn't give them that. All he said was he's not going to deport them.
And when we talk about the legal authority, the president knows the Republicans are waiting with attorneys on their payroll who are drooling at the chance to bring about a suit against him, as they already have with the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, I said, like vultures, you know, waiting for the guy to die in the desert kind of thing. So the president being an attorney himself and having, you know, a number of legal advisors at his disposal with the snap of a finger. I mean, how stupid would any president have to be, regardless of their political party, to present an executive action that they know they didn't have the legal authority to conduct?
Well, look, there were 39 executive orders in the last 50 years by every single president, getting back to Dwight D. Eisenhower, you name them, Nixon, Reagan, Ford, both Bushes, Clinton, Carter, they all did executive orders on immigration, much like the president's done. 39 in 50 years, that's almost one a year. So these things are pretty common. Now, presidents do sometimes skirt to the edge of the law. Frankly, I have real doubts about the Bush policy that Obama's continued about illegal spying on Americans' emails and finding out who we're writing to and things like that. So presidents often do skirt close to the line. I think that the presidential memo by Bush that authorized torture was against the law. And by the way, so did the Supreme Court. They overruled it. They said it was against the law. So, you know, sometimes presidents do skirt the law. But this is nothing like the Bush torture memos or even like the Bush/Obama policy to spy on people. This is well within what's been done by every single president in the last 50 years. Republicans don't like the policy. They have a right to complain about it. They don't have a right to call it illegal or unconstitutional.
Definitely when we look back to other presidents like Reagan and George W., they were, in a sense, providing executive order for relatives of theirs that were illegal. That wasn't the case with Daddy Bush, was it?
No, actually, Bush Sr. Basically said that 40% of the then group of undocumented immigrants in his day would not be deported. It's interesting because Obama's policy covers about 42%. It's just practically the same rough percentage that Obama said would not be deported. It's a very, very similar type executive order.
Most definitely. And you say, I don't want to jump around too much, but I know you can speak to it quickly. You know, and I know we've talked about it before. How successful, if at all, will Republicans be in their lawsuit against the president?
They will not win their lawsuit against the president. They have no chance.
Again, symbolic.
Yeah. Look, they realize that if they shut the government down again, the American people will hold them accountable. A few of them are calling for impeachment. I guess they want to impeach every Democratic president. There's really not much they can do. I'll tell you one thing they could do that would stop this flat. They could pass a law. They could simply pass the Senate bill, which has, you know, very strong enforcement standards and so forth. They could pass their own bill if they don't like the Senate bill. They could write a bill and it into law. They've been able to do this now for 6 years. They can do it tomorrow. All they have to do is agree and pass that law. That's the right way to go about it. Not a lawsuit, pass a law.
Okay, last but not least, congressional Republicans acknowledged yesterday that they're very limited in any options to curtail the president's executive action on immigration. There goes that legality theory, right?
Yeah, well, there's really not much they can do. I mean, obviously, look, at the end of the day, these executive orders only last as long as the president who signed them. It's not a permanent answer. As I said, there's no green card. No,
but they can stop the funding, though. That's a big option, can't they?
Here's the thing. The reason why the president has authority is because the funding is limited. People need to understand this. If the president had enough funding to deport all of the 11 million undocumented immigrants, you can make an argument that if he has the funding, he should do it. He doesn't, though. He's
right, and he doesn't have the legal authority. We are out of time, my love. I will talk to you next week. Have a good one. I'm Leslie Marshall.